headlines, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei receives the first dose of a domestically made coronavirus vaccine. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah, Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, slams the U.S. for seizing dozens of pro-resistance regional media outlets. And the death toll from the collapse of a 12-story residential building in the U.S. city of Miami rises to 4,159 people are still unaccounted for. Hello and welcome, everybody. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has received the first dose of a domestically produced COVID vaccine. Ayatollah Khamenei received the first shot of Coviran Batacat vaccine and thanked all those involved in producing it. The leader said there's nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he said he preferred to use an Iranian-made shot. Coviran Batacat was unveiled in December last year. Its mass production began 3 months later. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. The country is among the first nations to start developing coronavirus vaccines. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says an agreement to restore the 2015 Iran nuclear deal is, quote, within reach. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna since April to revive the agreement. The signatories adjourned the negotiations on Sunday for consultations and decision-making in their capitals. The deal originally envisioned the removal of anti-Iran sanctions in exchange for curbs on Iran's nuclear program. The former U.S. administration abandoned the agreement in 2018 as part of its maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Tehran also began reducing its nuclear deal commitments a year later. Iran says the U.S. must verifiably remove all its sanctions first in order to revive the deal. And the Russian capital has reported a daily record of 90 COVID deaths as the country is grappling with the third wave of the pandemic. Authorities also reported nearly 8,000 new cases in Moscow, nearly 40% of the country's daily caseload. The Delta strain represents 90% of the new infections. The surge prompted Moscow authorities to reimpose work-from-home restrictions on Friday. The city's mayor also ordered that businesses cut their number of in-office workers, except for vaccinated ones, by 30% from June 28th. All workers aged over 65, as well as those with pre-existing conditions, would have to work from home. Russia has seen an explosion of new cases since mid-June, with Moscow being the epicenter of the outbreak. The surge is blamed on the Delta variant, which was first identified in India. On this edition of the program, the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement has slammed as a clear act of aggression the U.S. seizure of dozens of Iranian and pro-resistance regional media outlets. Saeed Hassan Nasrallah said the shutdowns, even those of religious websites, were yet another American attempt to prevent the truth from being revealed. He added that the move once again demonstrates that successive U.S. administrations' claims of supporting freedom of religion and speech are fake. Nasrallah said the seizures come while the U.S. takes no action against outlets belonging to dictatorships and terrorist organizations and rather supports them. Elsewhere, Nasrallah dismissed as incitement U.S. accusations that Hezbollah wants to prevent the strengthening of the country's army. He said the U.S. seeks to sow strife in the region and serves Israel by preventing the Lebanese army from enhancing its military might. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. Also, we have activist and commentator Laith Maarouf, who's with us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier in Brussels. Please go over some of the key points made by Saeed Hassan Nasrallah. He opened his statements today condemning the U.S.'s move of the seizure of the websites of the resistance, and also said that the United States, he slammed the United States basically for trying to silence the resistance media, and that Washington is against any form of freedom of speech and religion.
Thank you for having me. Yes, we saw throughout the years how the U.S. deal with double standard with countries and with what it calls its principle of freedom of speech and democracy, but by shutting down 36 media outlets, it is a kind of a soft power that the U.S. is exerting over Iran and over its allies in the Middle East, but also over a channel that belongs to the Grand Ayatollah Saeed Sistani in Iraq and other to a U.S. Ally in Iraq, Saeed Anwar al-Hakim. Therefore, we see a little bit of clumsiness in the U.S. Administration behavior, trying to channel a message that these media outlets are hurting the U.S. Administration and is exposing it and exposing its doing in the Middle East, where many countries today refuse to have the presence of the U.S. forces on the ground. Therefore, it is not surprising to see how the Americans are using the soft power against these outlets, and in particularly against Iran, because there are many events that are happening, the Gaza battle, the Iranian ships to Venezuela, the negotiation in Vienna.
Okay, I believe we're experiencing some technical difficulties with Mr. Magni, and while we sort that out, let's cross over to Laith Maarouf in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Mr. Maarouf, some serious hypocrisy and double standards here from the United States. As we mentioned in our news piece, the U.S., it takes no action against outlets belonging to dictatorships and terrorist organizations, even supports them. But we've seen the recent seizures by Washington. How do you see this hypocrisy by Washington?
I mean, it is a show of weakness. That's what everybody should understand from it, because if the United States, with all its might, the imperial media empires that it controls, including all the media that it controls through the Gulf countries, cannot compete with the free market of thoughts and ideas against a few stations that are presenting revolutionary and liberationist thought, then that it means the United States is in big trouble. And what's funny about the stations that were shut down, not only obviously press media websites only that are with .com, .net, .org that are controlled by the United States, some of these stations included the children's television station, cartoons called Hoodhood. And so they're even scared of children's programming with the amazing Hollywood Disney budgets that they have. They think they can't compete. So the channels that got targeted, like Press TV, should definitely be proud of their achievement to come to the radar of the United States and be called a national threat to the aims of this empire.
Let's go back to Mr. Magni from Brussels. Some other points that were brought up in the Secretary General of Hezbollah speech today. He said that the United States, with regards to Lebanon, it's trying to sow strife amongst the Lebanese people, the Lebanese army, also sowing strife in the region. Who benefits from this?
The Americans have tried in the past, along with the Israelis, to defeat Hezbollah in 2006, and they have failed to achieve their objective. Now they've tried in the war in Syria in 2011, and again they failed. And due to the very dear economic situation in Lebanon, now they're trying to turn the population against Hezbollah, but they have failed, because their allies in the Lebanon are the ones responsible for the corruption in the last three decades. Therefore, the game of the American administration is very clear to the Lebanese. This is not Hezbollah's doing, but it is the government of Lebanon and also the U.S. tightening the flow of foreign currency and imposing sanctions on Syria. All that is affecting Lebanon. And in relation to the Lebanese army, the Russians and the Iranians and many countries offer to support the Lebanese army with weapons, but the Americans refuse because they don't want any weapon that pose a threat to Israel. This is why this is not going to happen. We're not going to see a strong Lebanese army, but we see a Lebanese army that is supplied with vehicles and with light weapons and anything that can fit, with the possibility of a civil war, because this is the Americans' wishful thinking.
Back to Mr. Maruf in Beirut. Leif, you're in Lebanon, you're in Beirut. I've spoken to you about developments in Lebanon before. You always give us a detailed account of events taking place there. Talk to us about some of the measures that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah mentioned about required to reach a solution to form a cabinet. He highlighted and warned basically against sectarian strife amid the talks on forming a new cabinet in Lebanon. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was listening to the speech just before we came on air here. It was still going on, wrapping up some of the thoughts. And he clearly, took on all the detractors that have been trying to sow some strife within the population. And he reiterated that he will be solving the problem of gasoline and fuel in the country if the government doesn't take its responsibility. And he said clearly today that all the logistics have been ironed out with Iran to bring in oil that is refined, including gasoline and fuel for the electricity generators. So he's waiting for giving one last chance for the government to deliver on its promises. And also he spoke to those who complain when Hezbollah brings these solutions, that if they have their own friends, the Saudis, the Gulf, the United States, and they can bring oil from those countries or bring food that is subsidized from those countries, that he prays for them to achieve it, but that he will be working on his own also to do that. So to clarify that they're not standing against anybody bringing any help to Lebanon as Hezbollah. It is the others who are complaining anytime Hezbollah brings aid to the country. And we know clearly through the last 3 years that the Saudis and the Americans behind them have been not allowing a government to coagulate, to make sure that the political victory of Hezbollah and those who are allied with it, like the Patriotic National Party of President Aoun, do not actually are able to bring good to this country. So we've wasted 3 years. There's less than a year left in this presidency, and that's the whole plan of the Americans, been to make sure that this government doesn't deliver anything.
All right, thanks a lot. Activist and commentator Leif Maruf joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Also thanks to journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier speaking to us from Brussels. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, the French foreign minister says Paris and Washington have agreed to jointly put pressure on Lebanese officials responsible for the political and economic crisis in the Arab country.
We have noted together the tragedy that it would be for this country to break up, to disappear. We have made the same observation, and we have decided, ladies and gentlemen, to act together to put pressure on the people responsible for the blockage. We know who they are, and it's not the inaction that will provide a solution.
Le Drian was speaking at a news conference with his visiting U.S. counterpart, Antony Blinken. He said Lebanon is heading toward a dramatic collapse, and political leaders there are unable to take up the slightest challenge. The top French diplomat did not elaborate on potential measures or Lebanese officials they might target. Blinken, for his part, said both Paris and Washington want to see what he called real leadership in Beirut, Lebanon is on the brink of financial collapse, with the Lebanese pound having lost more than 90% of its value. The country was, rather, has been without a government since August last year. Well, the Yemeni army says it has launched a new drone attack against Saudi Arabia. The army says the latest attack hit King Khalid Airbase in the southwest of Saudi Arabia. It said the strike was conducted precisely and was in response to Saudi-led aggression against Yemen. On Tuesday, Yemen also used 10 drones to hit a command post and training site near the Saudi border. Some 60 people were killed or injured. Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies, backed by Washington, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed, many of them women and children. The death toll from the collapse of a 12-story residential building in the U.S. city of Miami, Florida, rises to 4, while scores of people still remain unaccounted for.
Unfortunately, this has been a tragic night. We do have 120 people now accounted for, which is very, very good news. But our unaccounted for number has gone up to 159. In addition, we can tragically report the death count is now 4.
The mayor said search and rescue operations are on the way to find possible survivors in the rubble. Authorities have stressed that it is still unclear how many people were inside when the tragedy happened in the early hours of Thursday. Earlier, President Joe Biden approved an emergency declaration in the state of Florida and ordered federal assistance to supplement state and local response efforts. There was no immediate word on the cause of the collapse of the 40-year-old tower. The building was undergoing roof construction and other repairs. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
As immigrant rights advocates have pointed out, the increases in the number of positive COVID-19 cases among the people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement appear to be connected to ICE's refusal to systematically provide COVID-19 vaccines to the people in its custody. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Philip Do Lajos, writer. This article is published under the heading, Recent COVID-19 Spike in Immigration Detention Was a Problem of ICE's Own Making. Here's more. In May, as the number of people detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement began to swell, the number of positive COVID-19 cases shot up dramatically. On May 19th, the agency reported over 2,100 cases, a more than six-fold increase from the beginning of March, concentrated in detention facilities in Mississippi and Louisiana. As immigrant rights advocates have pointed out, the increases appear to be connected to ICE's refusal to systematically provide COVID-19 vaccines to the people in its custody. Even when vaccines are offered by state health departments, The Intercept has found detained people are not always taking them, sometimes due to skepticism of medical care in ICE custody, and sometimes due to detention officials' careless effort to inform people about the vaccine's availability. In addition, The Intercept has found that the increase in coronavirus cases coincided with ICE's decision to transfer detainees through a Mississippi facility where cases were exploding, effectively spreading the virus to various other detention centers in the South. Despite the fact that the agency has previously acknowledged in internal documents that such transfers cause outbreaks. Transfers in and of themselves are high risk. Every time you travel by bus, by public transportation, with other people, there is a high risk of transmission and a high risk of being infected, especially if you're not tested and you are asymptomatically infected, said Dr. Ranit Misori, a professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine and senior medical advisor to Physicians for Human Rights, adding, "If I were running the ICE medical operation, getting a vaccination program underway would be my absolute top choice." He said, as is everything with COVID, there is no one solution. From mid-March to mid-May, as President Joe Biden's administration began to allow more asylum seekers into the U.S., the number of people in ICE detention grew from about 14,000 to 20,400, representing about a 45% increase. The number of confirmed active COVID-19 cases over the same period went from about 475 to 2,100, about a 340% increase. The Biden administration continues to expel most asylum seekers immediately upon their entry into the U.S. under an obscure public health rule called Title 42. Those who make it through are screened for infection. ICE does not report infections among its staff, but there have long been indications that the staff bring the virus into detention centers, not the other way around. The loci of the outbreaks were in Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arizona, where ICE has a robust detention infrastructure. The spread can also be tied to lagging vaccination rates as a whole. Louisiana ranks 48th out of 51 states, including Washington, D.C., while Mississippi is dead last, with about 28% of its adult population fully vaccinated. For months, ICE has refused to take responsibility for vaccinating people in its custody, punting the task to state and local officials, despite the fact that civil immigration detainees are inarguably in federal custody, even when held in local jails and private detention centers. As a result, vaccine offerings have been inconsistent across detention centers, including in the states where there was an outbreak last month. Ryan Gustin, a spokesperson for the private detention company, Core Civic said the company is working with ICE and the State Health Department to administer the vaccine, but did not address whether vaccines are currently being made available or how many have been administered so far. Spokesperson for the Louisiana Department of Health did not respond to questions, though people detained by ICE in the state told Intercept vaccines had been offered at various centers. The spokesperson for GEO Group, a private prison company that operates several centers in Louisiana, referred questions to ICE and LaSalle Corrections, which runs two Louisiana immigration detention facilities, did not respond to questions. A regional spokesperson for ICE also did not respond to questions. According to advocates, attorneys, and multiple people who passed through the Adams County Detention Center, the facility in Natchez, Mississippi, has been a stopping point for people brought in from the southern border and bound for other detention centers in the south, mostly Louisiana. The Immigration Enforcement Agency does not publicly report transfers between its facilities, but there are reasons to believe the COVID-19 spike originated at Adams and spread elsewhere in the region. At the end of April, ICE reported 232 cases at Adams, while the agency's other facilities in Mississippi and Louisiana were at 50 or less. By May 21st, the number of recorded cases at Adams was 415, more than any other ICE facility. And about a fifth of all acknowledged cases in ICE facilities nationwide. The Richwood Correctional Center in Monroe, Louisiana, had shot up to 196 cases, while the Jackson Parish Correctional Center in Monroe reached 86, and the South Louisiana ICE Processing Center hit 61. Raman, who said he spent about a day at Adams before testing positive for COVID-19 and was transferred immediately to the River Correctional Center in Faraday, Louisiana, called Adams a trampoline from which asylum seekers were being bounced around. The Intercept is referring to Raman and all others in IC custody by pseudonyms due to their fear of retaliation by detention officials. Several people who passed through Adams reported that they were given COVID-19 tests upon their arrival, but not always upon their exit or arrival at other centers. Raman claimed that after he and four others were transferred to River with still active infections, they were put in isolation but left largely untreated.
We the people.
U.S. gun crisis.
Battles related to gun rights and gun control have been going on in the United States for long, and not only in the streets, but also in media airways. Yet, the forces of gun rights and gun control often fail to find common ground as many families keep suffering from consequences of gun violence.
It was quiet. It wasn't snowing, but it smelled like snow. And then the call came in and it felt like the world was crashing.
Every fear that you have as a parent, it all comes crashing down on you at one time.
And I could tell from her reaction that he was dead. And you know it's bad to lose a child, but it takes you down to a place you've never been before.
It's 9 years for me, and I'm still suffering every single day.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Milad Javan Mahdi. welcome to the show. In this episode, we will ask, isn't it enough already? Around 40,000 people die as a result of firearm injuries in the United States every year, and many more are wounded. Mass shootings make national headlines, while cases of gun violence or suicide are repeatedly reported.
Supporters of gun control in the United States are lashing out at President Joe Biden over his lack of action to address one of the key issues the nation has been facing for decades, despite vowing to do so during the 2020 presidential campaign. The so-called right to keep and bear arms, which was initially put in place to guarantee the safety of people, has now turned into a major issue.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of the free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. What this is saying is that if regular people like you and like me are expected to participate in a militia, then we must have arms, we must have guns in order to fulfill that duty. Now, to me, that seems clear enough, but today, for some reason, it's very cloudy. You see, opponents of gun rights argue that with a standing army as large as we have, and with police forces and National Guardsmen, that militias are obviously an obsolete part of that constitutional amendment. And if militias are no longer needed, individual gun ownership is also no longer needed.
As some authorities are making efforts to prevent deadly shootings, there are also those making profit and gaining an ever-increasing power from the gun culture. Our first guest today is Ramiro Funes, an activist and political commentator based in Los Angeles. Mr. Funes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Mr. Funes, do you see any significant change in gun violence recently?
Under Biden's presidency, there hasn't been a significant change to gun ownership, to gun rights, or gun limitations in the United States. It's been one of the issues that have been on the back burner for President Biden. I think a major issue that Biden has yet to overcome or address, which is central and core to understanding gun violence in the United States, is drug usage and poverty. In a lot of the states and cities where gun violence is increasing, for example, in New York City, where I am from, I'm born and raised in New York, and also in Chicago, in Illinois, where there are huge amounts of gun violence.
Some very interesting points there. Many thanks for your insight, Mr. Funes.
The issue of gun control has returned to countries' political discourse in the wake of daily gun violence spinning out of control in the country. Defined as four or more people killed in one shooting incident, mass shootings get the bulk of media attention, and every few days there are equivalents of that in places with high rates of gun violence, such as the cities of Baltimore and Chicago.
I know people who can't walk from their house to the store without a gun on them.
Why is that a reality? Why do people feel like they have to have a gun on them?
Because people getting killed left and right. It's sad.
I got shot twice, and I could have been gone, but I'm still here, so that's God. I know that's with me, so this hell on earth.
It's hell on earth?
Yeah, it's hell on earth.
Just recently, four mass shootings in 6 hours left nearly 40 people wounded and five others dead across the country. The level of gun violence across the country is indeed disturbing. We're now joined by Garland Nixon, a radio talk show host and political analyst, an outspoken civil libertarian and First Amendment advocate, currently serving on the National Board of Directors for the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU. Welcome to the show, sir.
Oh, you're certainly welcome.
Mr. Nixon, some people were assuming that with Biden in power, chances of a better gun control would grow. Has that materialized?
Well, I would argue that it was put forth by the mainstream media that if Joe Biden got in power, that we would see some changes in gun control. But I don't think anyone really believed it. I think that was something that was put forward to, you know, to strengthen President Biden's chances of winning during the electoral season. Since he's been in power, he's written one executive order, which doesn't have a lot of power, and basically he authorizes the Department of Justice to write a report and to write some proposed legislation, and that's all that's happened so far.
Thanks again for joining us, Mr. Nixon. Stay tuned for more.
President Biden has already introduced several executive actions to reduce gun violence, including banning so-called ghost guns and prioritizing community violence prevention in existing programs. The Republicans, meanwhile, keep crying out that such moves violate the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution.
Inaction has made this horror completely predictable. Inaction by this Congress makes us complicit.
Some gun safety measures, like one bill aimed at expanding background check requirements, have stalled in the Senate. Background checks are supposed to save lives in a lot of ways, not only by keeping guns out of the hands of people who should not have them, but also by addressing gun trafficking, which plays a key role in gun violence. Are background checks reliable, and will they work in reducing violence caused by gun bearers?
I believe that background checks will not reduce violence caused by guns because ultimately what it comes down to are material economic conditions that people are faced with. You can have people with perfectly healthy and fine backgrounds who have committed no crimes, who have no prior arrests or warrants, who have not been in any sort of trouble with the law. But if they're put in a situation where they've lost their job, where they have no other opportunity to survive, where they're in an impoverished community, where other people are attacking or robbing them, a lot of times people will turn to guns.
When it comes to gun policy in the US, the elephant in the room is the ease of access to firearms by those planning to traumatize vulnerable communities inside the United States. Efforts for stricter gun laws and background checks have been hampered by pro-gun lobbies, most notably the National Rifle Association.
The NRA, the National Rifle Association, is extremely powerful in shaping gun policies, although the so-called gun rights advocacy group has no more than 5 million members across the United States. Biden has claimed that he took on gun lobbies before, but could he expect his administration to achieve in this regard during the Democratic president's tenure?
You know, I don't expect the Biden administration to achieve anything. For starters, they would have to get rid of the filibuster. They would have to do filibuster reform of some manner in order to achieve something, and it doesn't certainly appear that they're going to do that. I don't think that they really want to do that. The other part of it is Joe Biden won by such a narrow margin, and the Democratic Party seems to really believe that they have to lean right rather than lean in the direction of the left, the progressives, the anti-war, anti-corporate, you know, pro-organized labor left. Rather than lean in that direction, they tend to lean in the direction of the right, of the more conservative or hardliners in the U.S., and this would be offensive to them. So I expect the Biden administration to rhetorically do a few head nods in the direction of those who would want gun reform.
Infighting and partisanship have been at the core of the reason for the delay in gun safety laws. But U.S. firearms industry is deeply entrenched in a vicious web of manufacturers, retailers, lobbyists, and at its very heart, the National Rifle Association, the most powerful gun rights organization in the world, with a long history and no intention to change course.
The lobbying by some of the most powerful groups in America has worked in their favor. For more than 130 years, the NRA's policy has been simple, yet destructive, selling more and more guns, apparently regardless of its cost for communities. The NRA also boasts about its legislative achievements, as pro-gun figures hold ultimate power over the White House and the U.S. Senate. But why are so many people resorting to guns anyway?
Biden will not be able to overcome gun violence in the United States unless he overcomes the problem of private prisons, the problem of privatization and unemployment, of jobs being outsourced and sent to other countries. People are turning to guns as the only solution for their problems because they don't have any other option in a lot of these cities. And what's interesting to note is that a lot of this is being fueled by media that is inciting violence between two different sides of society in the United States, and also because we see a lack of opportunity in a lot of cities where people no longer have access to jobs and resources.
Biden has described the situation as a public health epidemic of gun violence, but he has failed to convince the deeply partisan Senate to pass gun legislation. Staunch Republican opposition to gun control has been there for a long time.
I don't know, but all I know is that you've got to continue to try. It will eventually pass.
Some will argue that if someone is intent on doing great violence, they will find a gun.
Let's assume that's true, okay? Whether they find a gun or they find the equivalent of an AR-15 depends on how much damage they can do.
Victims of gun violence, particularly minorities such as the black community, are the main victims of the situation. They are disappointed with the Biden administration and skeptical about the administration's ability to bring about real change in the midst of pressure from the powerful pro-gun groups.
I always say that the only difference between domestic and foreign policy in the United States is grammatical. The U.S. is at odds with any potential adversaries, and internally, domestically, the two parties are now adversarial groups, and they are at odds, they are at war, they demonize each other. So basically, the Republicans, as the opposition party, their entire platform is built on opposing the Democrats on all fronts. So I think that the partisanship is central in the nation's struggle for gun control.
A ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines and an end to gun manufacturers' immunity from liability are among the items on top of the agenda for gun control. Assault weapons are capable of firing a lot of rounds in a minute. The so-called red flag laws or extreme risk protective orders also need to be addressed.
A new law in the state of Colorado has added certain conditions to the right to bear arms. The law allows family members or law enforcement to ask a judge to temporarily remove guns from the possession of someone deemed an extreme risk to themselves or others. Sheriff Byerly says he will not take an individual's guns as a precaution.
The reason that I don't believe in the ERPO or red flag law, and I don't believe that it's lawful, is because of the very clear violations of the Constitution.
Background check laws have been loose as the government tries to see gun buyers fully vetted before making a purchase. But making changes to the Constitution and creating new laws are not enough, as manufacturers often try to circumvent the law by making minor changes that do not limit the weapon's lethality.
Those of us, and as you know, I'm a former police officer, who feel that we do need to make some adjustments in our gun regulations and, you know, minor adjustments maybe, some more significant. But the gun lobby who opposes any changes simply tries to state our position as if it is a complete, revolutionary change of our gun laws. And so basically when someone who's in favor of changes in the gun regulations says, we put forward a proposal for a minor change, they change it and they interpret it as a full change. So the slightest little change is, oh, they want to completely take your guns, they want to get rid of all guns. It's a fear tactic to change the subject and to frighten Americans away from any type of gun reform at all, kind of the camel under the camel's nose under the tent kind of argument.
But there are also those who care so much about their guns. The pro-gun portion of society are mostly conservatives. They often cite the Second Amendment to defend their passion for guns. They believe the Department of Justice is enforcing a selective reading of civil rights in the country. There is also the assertion that gun rights may actually expand through a Supreme Court decision.
In a 2008 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court determined that the Second Amendment protects an individual's right to keep and bear arms. pro-gun activists argue that the DOJ's efforts empower the government to extinguish Americans' Second Amendment right and confiscate their firearms without due process. But who are the true victims and what is their situation like?
We also see a rise in unemployment. We see jobs leaving those cities. We see rents going up, mortgages going up, job wages going down, job numbers going down. And so underlying the gun crisis in the United States is poverty, unemployment. And because of that, people have taken to abusing substances, abusing drugs, and also using guns as a way to engage in activities and crimes that they otherwise wouldn't do if they had no other option left to do so, if there were jobs and opportunities available.
Furthermore, records of almost 500,000 fugitives from justice who were prohibited from purchasing firearms were reportedly deleted from the background check system. Firearms also need to be kept out of the hands of abusers, as domestic violence is also interconnected with gun violence.
It would take a significant amount of push from grassroots organizations, and you know, people would have to be in the street before it would happen. And I don't see that happening because there's so much pain in so many areas in the United States and so much concern. And as I said, the Biden administration, they are focused on foreign policy, and they seem to be doing just enough when it comes to domestic policy to keep the House from burning down completely and then turning their focus outward again. So, no, I don't think they'll make a difference, and I don't think they really intend to. I think they want to rhetorically, voice support for gun reform and then run away from it as quickly as they can.
Apart from the battles, the power play, and the legislation, it is the responsibility of every single firearms owner to make sure their weapons are used safely. Human lives are precious, and it is a shame to see the rising death toll of the victims of violence during a given year in the United States.
On tonight's episode of We the People, I'm joined by Kalanji Changa. He's an author, filmmaker, community organizer, co-host of the Renegade Culture podcast, co-founder of Black Power Media, and the founder of the FTP movement. Kalanji, thanks so much for joining us. We're discussing the recent rash of mass shootings in the U.S., and there's a lot to talk about here, and certainly a number of people with, I think, pretty legitimate reasons to want some level of gun control. So what can you tell us about what's being portrayed in corporate media as a serious epidemic of gun violence, and what are some of the concerns that folks in your community have about the broader issue going forward?
Well, I think that as far as the violence is concerned, I think part of the issue that people in my community have is that it is a lack of truth. You know, oftentimes, you know, the media, they say it's just it's black on black violence, or it's just they point at the individual opposed to the fact that it's a systemic situation. The fact that gun violence is a result of the violence that exists in this country. You know what I mean? This is a country that was built off of violence. This is a country that was built off of the gun. You know, so, Americans are entertained by violence. You know what I mean? Some of the biggest stars in the world, or the biggest stars in the United States, from a John Wayne to a Clint Eastwood, you know what I mean? Their movies have been violent, the video games, so on and so forth. On top of that, we live in a situation in a society where the U.S. is the number one producer of arms, and you know, with that you expect some type of, you know, violence. They're not producing arms for the sake of, just making new friends. You know, it's a multi-billion-dollar industry.
We're talking about this on an international level, Kalanji. I know this is something that has affected you on a very personal level. Can you discuss how this gun violence issue, how this violence issue more broadly in the United States has impacted you personally, and how this shapes the way that you're looking at the issue.
Okay, yes. growing up, I'm from Bridgeport, Connecticut. And Bridgeport is about 45 minutes away from New York City. And, you know, it's the same radio, television, same crime, same situation. You know, and I've had most recently, you know, I had my son, my 15-year-old, 3 days before his 16th birthday, he was shot in the drive-by. You know, luckily, you know, he survived, you know, but my brother up in Connecticut, he was shot while he was in a car with some friends. You know, someone just walked up and opened fire on the car, you know, someone he didn't even know. You know, my cousin, age 16, I remember getting a phone call that he was shot and bleeding in the streets. You know, so, you know, so many friends I've lost, so many family members who have been victims of quote-unquote gun violence, but we don't sum it up. It's just, you know, there being a problem with guns because of the fact that it's not necessarily the gun, it's the mind behind the gun. You know what I mean? It's the fact that the conditions that exist, you know, we blame it on the conditions that exist, and we look at it from a holistic perspective, not just pointing fingers and saying, you know, well, this is some type of, situation in a vacuum. You know, we know it's not in a vacuum. We know that this is, again, this is the nature of the state, the regime that we're in. It's the nature of the country.
Yeah, it definitely seems pretty difficult to separate the violence we see in the streets from the violence we see on the silver screen here in the United States. We want to thank you so much, Kalonji Changa, for joining us tonight. We want to thank viewers at home as well for tuning in. In Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed. Take care.
Daily acts of gun violence disproportionately impact communities of color. It's no surprise to see those communities rise today demanding that President Biden keep his word and take action against gun violence. That was our show. Thank you for tuning in. Join us again next week on We the People.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.